Support for NPR podcasts comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. War by war, icon by icon, public television documentarian Ken Burns is putting his trademark video stamp on American history. With his colossally popular renderings of the Civil War and baseball, Mark Twain and jazz, Thomas Jefferson, Lewis and Clark, and more, Burns, often with collaborator Lynn Novick, is shaping our collective memory of what we've been, our sense of what we are. This time out, it's with a massive retelling of World War II. Millions are watching. Up next on Point, Ken Burns and co-producer Lynn Novick on their latest march on American history, The War. Joining me now from New York is Ken Burns, one of the best-known documentary filmmakers in American history. His film, The Civil War, in 1990, was a PBS blockbuster, the highest-rated series in public television history. His other film documentaries include Mark Twain in 02, Jazz in 01, The Brooklyn Bridge. Brooklyn Bridge, way back in 1981, Burns is co-producer of the new documentary, The War, 15 hours, 7 parts, airing now on PBS. Ken Burns, welcome. Great to have you.
Thank you so much.
And with us from New York is Lynn Novick, who co-produced The War. She began working with Ken Burns way back in 1989 on The Civil War. She was also behind the documentaries Baseball, Frank Lloyd Wright, and Jazz. Lynn Novick, welcome. Wonderful to have you as well.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's great to be here.
Lynn is actually the co-director as well. This is an equal project of Lynn and me.
I love it, and thank you for reminding us. What's the division of labor here, Ken and Lynn? How did you go about divvying it up? There's an epic amount of labor here in putting together The War.
We actually just spent the whole time in the same foxhole together, just trying to survive.
Keeping our helmet strapped
tightly.
Must be funky in there.
Sharing a lot of the work. Lynn did most of the interviews and directed the kind of day-to-day production of the film. And I find I'm most helpful in the editing room, sort of understanding narrative and structure and things like that.
I was just going to say,
in addition to me and Ken, Jeffrey Ward, who writes our scripts,
of course,
plays an equally important role in sort of taking the material that we come up with and really helping us to figure out how to put the words to the story.
Lynn, Ken famously notes that he noted that 1,000 World War II vets were dying per day. I mean, in the process of this, you're dealing with people who are not in the youth of their lives anymore. You were interviewing over many years. Some of those you interviewed, as I understand, are now gone as the documentary comes out.
Yes, it's been really an odyssey for us. We started talking to people who were in their mid to late 70s. Now they're in their mid to late 80s, and they have aged. Most of the people that we met and that are in the film are still going strong, which is very exciting, but it has been very sad to know that we lost 5 of the people that we interviewed, and they didn't quite make it. One passed away as recently as about a month ago, and we were devastated, as was his family, that he couldn't be around to share and all the recognition. And what we tried to do in the film is to honor the veterans by having them tell their own stories. So it's particularly poignant that some of them are not here to see that we have hopefully done that.
We want to keep the voice of those veterans in our ears as we talk with you, Lynn, and Ken Burns today. People will have been listening to this, but let's just get a bit of it. After all, they were the ones who fought. Many died. Here from The War is Sam Hines, a bomber pilot, reflecting on why teenagers from Minneapolis enlisted in 1941.
You have to imagine what it was like to be a teenage middle class, lower middle class kid in Minneapolis in 1941. The chances for excitement were fairly limited. You could drive a car fast, you could get drunk, you could take a girl out and try and get somewhere and fail. That's local excitement. But to have an exciting life, it was hard to imagine what an exciting life would be. And then suddenly, you could be a pilot or a submariner or an artilleryman or any damn thing, but it was something exciting and it was something adult.
The trip from that Sound of Innocence to Too Much Knowing came pretty fast for Sam Hinds.
I don't think there is such a thing as a good war. There are sometimes necessary wars. And I think one might say just wars. And that I never questioned the necessity of that war, and I still do not question it. It was something that had to be done.
Ken Burns, there have been so many films, documentaries, dramas, poems, novels, orchestral pieces written on World War II. Yes, 1,000 Vets for Dying a Day. Tom Brokaw's just been there as well. I mean, with all of that, what pushed you to say, no, we've got to do it one more time? And what were you trying to set out to do something that had not been done before?
You're right. You know, we could have taken a pass on this. This has saturated our culture, this cottage industry of World War II stuff. But I think Lynn and I felt that there had not been anything that had gotten at the heart of what the situation was about, what it was like to actually be in battle, on the front line, by the people who are fighting and dying, to have a sense of the continuity of the struggle. This is the first documentary that I know that covers the European and the Pacific and the home front simultaneously. To understand the story of the Second World War without being distracted by the generals and the politicians, the strategy and tactics, the armaments and the weaponry that sort of impose themselves between what actually took place, what battle is like, and our understanding of that story.
Lynn, it's a brave thing to wait in here again. I mean, maybe nothing in the world of documentary film has exactly done that, and yet, you know, between our novelists and poets and you name it, we have had some big minds on this war for many years.
You know, I would say it's terrifying. It was particularly terrifying at the beginning of the project when we really didn't quite know what we were going to do. We definitely were very mindful of all the wonderful things that have been done in the past. But what we hoped is that if we could find the veterans who could tell their stories to us in a sort of honest and really realistic way, we would get at some of these sort of deeper universal experiences of what happens to human beings in the world of war, and that we would add something new that, because veterans, I think, now are more willing to talk about their experiences because they're getting older, they want their grandchildren to know what they went through, they realize that if they don't tell it, no one will ever know. And there's just a sense, a little bit of opening up for some people. We felt we had an opportunity to really delve a little bit more deeply into sort of the complicated, intimate stories of what it really was like to be there.
Let's get a sense
and
of just...
I hope we have done that.
Well, no doubt. A sense here of just how intimate. Many Japanese Americans, as you point out, on the mainland were interred in prison camps after Pearl Harbor. In Hawaii, they never were. In 1943, a new all-Japanese regiment formed, which recruited volunteers from the camps as well as from Hawaii. In a call for Hawaiian volunteers that same year, 10,000 showed up. One of those, Daniel Inouye, who later received a Bronze Star and is now a senator from Hawaii.
My father took time off, and we got on the streetcar. And he was very silent until we got close to the point of departure. He cleared his throat, and I knew something was coming. He's not a scholarly person, but I know he struggled. And he said, "This country has been good to us. It has given me two jobs. It has given you and your brothers and your sister education. We owe a lot to this country. Do not dishonor this country. Above all, do not dishonor the family. And if you must die, die in honor." You know, I'm 18 years old, and here he is telling me these heavy words. And I've always thought to myself, would I be able to say the same thing to my son?
Daniel Inouye, now Senator Daniel Inouye, speaking there in The War, co-produced and directed by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. Ken Burns with that elegiac kind of piano, almost the Ken Burns sound
Let's listen for just a moment to the coda of Senator Daniel Inouye's description of his time going into war, being in war, during the American time of soldiers in Germany. American soldiers were encouraged, the war tells us, to be tough with Germans, they found. Daniel Inouye talks here about what it meant to be in war, to honor your country, to be tough.
This one experience was so bad that I had to see the chaplain. We had just attacked a farmhouse, and I ran up there, and sure enough, there were three Germans, two dead and one alive. He was leaning against the wall, and he spoke in German, and I don't speak German, and he was saying, "Kamerad, Kamerad," and he had his hand up there to surrender. Then all of a sudden, he stuck his hand into his jacket. And the only conclusion I could reach instantaneously was that he was going for a gun. So almost instinctively, I reacted and I hit his face with the butt of my rifle. And his hand flew out, and in his hand was a bunch of photographs. He wanted to show me pictures of his wife and his children. That's war.
That's war, says Senator Daniel Inouye in Ken Burns and Lynn Novick's new The War, 15 hours, 7 parts. Lynn Novick, many World War II vets famously in the early years after the war did not want to talk about it. What did you find when you went out with the microphone and the camera now, when many of them are, you know, in the twilight of their lives? Were they opening up in a new way, in a different way, did they say to themselves than they had before? Or had the stories become, you know, over-polished with time? How did you find? Was there a general rule?
You know, that's a great question, and I think there isn't any one single rule, because we do have quite a wide range of people who have different relationships to their own history and their own experience. Some people do have their polished chestnuts that they have told many times. Some people had not talked about it at all, and at the urging of family or friends, sort of finally agreed to do it. But one thing that we did find is that, and I'm not sure I can say why this is, but maybe just some sense of posterity or legacy, that even if these were stories they had told a lot, they sometimes were able to just delve a little bit deeper into how they felt about things, or just let their emotions come forward a little bit more and not just make light of things like some people do. And so just sometimes in just looking at their faces and seeing the expressions, maybe a twitch or just a gulp or something like that, you can feel the weight of what they're trying to say, even if they might even be making a joke at that moment, or they might be sort of using a euphemism to describe something that's pretty terrible. You know, they might say something like, Ken did a great interview with a guy named Ward Chamberlain, and he talked about being an ambulance driver and taking someone into his ambulance who was in very bad shape, and then they found out that this person was about to die. They stopped the car. They got out. They sort of spent a little bit of time with him, and he paused, and he said, you know, seeing some guy leave this world, it's not a lot of fun. I mean, not a lot of fun. My goodness, it's, I'm sure, beyond horrible, but he would never say exactly that. He's sort of just, I'm not going to say he's tossing it off, but he's just sort of putting in the vernacular of it's not a lot of fun. And yet when you're looking at his face and he's telling you this, you understand the weight of it and how he has to carry that around with him. And that's what we really found, is that by being sort of close up with people, things come out that they may not even be aware that are, you know, being allowed to be expressed.
Let's hear some of that in an account of hardship during the American effort to take the small Japanese-held island of Peleliu. September 1944, Eugene Sledge from Mobile, Alabama, kept a diary of his experience.
It was the darkest night I ever saw. The overcast sky was as black as the dripping mangroves that walled us in. I had the sensation of being in a great black hole and reaching out to touch the sides of the gun pit to orient myself. Slowly, the reality of it all formed in my mind. We were expendable. It was difficult to accept. We come from a nation and a culture that values life and the individual. To find oneself in a situation where your life seems of little value is the ultimate in loneliness.
From the diary there of Eugene Sledge of Mobile, Alabama, Ken Burns, there's a line early on, widely noted, Maybe Jeffrey Ward wrote it, but there it is in the war. The Second World War, goes the line, brought out the best and the worst in a generation and blurred the two so that they became at times almost indistinguishable. That is a bit different from the Tom Brokaw Greatest Generation line. What's meant by that?
Well, I'm not sure it's different from Tom Brokaw's thing, but it's certainly different from the John Wayne version of the Second World War. War is chaos. It's the worst kind of chaos, as most of life is. And we try to superimpose a narrative on it. And the narratives that we usually superimpose on war are self-serving. They're about bravery and courage, very, very important things. And we miss the opportunity to actually experience the calculus of war, the cost of war. And that's what we were attempting to do here. You hear it in Eugene Sledge's voice. Is it possible to stand there in the midst of that chaos and tolerate it for what it is, the notion that his life is expendable and that, yes, it brought out the best, of course, and the worst. And it's important to be mindful of the simultaneity of this. The soldiers who fought in that war saw bad things. They did bad things. They lost good friends. And let us not mince words. When you join the military, your job is to kill other people, and you do that in war, and you have horrible experiences that blur the lines of distinction. And when you get into a situation like Peleliu, it dissolves almost completely. It doesn't mean that we as filmmakers lose our perspective of who the aggressors are and who the good guys are and what the ultimate outcome is. But when you see what soldiers like Eugene Sledge are forced to do by the circumstances, this is not a political discussion. This is a human discussion, that when they are forced by the circumstances of war, the lie of civilization, to do the things they have to do. He says it a little bit later on. It was like two scorpions in a bottle fighting to the death. You know, one kills each other, the one nearly so. Mm. And that's what happens. And we were just privileged, as Lynn is suggesting, to be ushered into the lives of these 40-odd folks who were willing to share with us some stuff that does not seem practiced anymore, that seems like we were getting memory sometimes as it was being expressed for the first time.
And those interviews and the old still photographs, once again, the old film clips and the new are incredibly moving. I mean, you put them back to back, the numbers that you describe here about World War II, it's all kind of overwhelming. But let me ask you, Ken Burns, you know, in a way, with the Civil War and all your other work, you have yourself, in a way, become a kind of icon. And interestingly, this time out, you're getting some tough critical response to this documentary as well. Not everybody is loving this one. They're saying, oh, come on, what's the new thing here? Or, what are you telling us we haven't heard before? Or if, you know, and we can kind of hear it in that beautiful reading from the diary just there. I mean, you make it, yes, it's horrible, but it's also somehow, it's elegiacally beautiful. Do you ever worry that there's a, your very talents as a filmmaker may bring a kind of Norman Rockwell gloss to this, turn war, despite all of everything you're saying here, into a kind of, you know, pageant history that makes it alluring, comforting even as we see the death toll and the death.
Oh, I would disagree completely. This film is beyond that in many ways. And in fact, we've received the best notices of our professional lives and the highest viewer tune-ins, which is, of course, the greatest barometer of that. I do think that when you're out in the mainstream, just as a filmmaker, let's just divorce it from this project, and maybe Lynn would be a much better person to answer your question about it. But when you're out there, people take pot shots at it. The overwhelming, 99% of the reviews have been the best of our professional lives, and the response has been overwhelming. We are in a funny media culture in which people find it very hard now to submit to narrative, to actually devote the time. And that goes not just for ordinary people, which we're always excoriating for not having attention spans, and they do, but it also goes for critics and others who are also afraid of the emotional archaeology that we are engaged in. And I'd love to have Lynn respond to that too, because it's so far away from what this film is. And I hope that you've actually seen some of this, because you know that this is not Norman Rockwell.
Yeah, I mean, it really... don't quite know what to say except that what we tried to do, and we hope we have succeeded, is to really present a pretty unvarnished and very unsentimental depiction of what the reality of war is. And the inspiration really was, you know, someone like Paul Fussell, who Ken also interviewed, who said, we tend to call it the real war, not the showbiz war. The real war involves getting down there and killing people and being killed yourself or nearly escaping it. And that's what we really tried to show. And when we've shown the film to veterans who were there, they have said to us that it is as realistic as anything that they can imagine. So there's a lot of very difficult things to look at. It is not romanticized in any way, shape, or form. And I guess we don't really feel the Norman Rockwell analogy is apt at all. I mean, we do present the home front, but we also show a lot of the complexities of life on the home front. And I think it was as true as we could make it with the testimonies that we had and the materials that we found. But hopefully the viewers will make up their own minds about that.
Let's go to our listeners. A lot of them want to join the conversation. We've got one right now, maybe depicted in the documentary, a caller from Corvallis, Oregon. Robert is on the line. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi. I enjoy your show very, very much. In March in 1944, I was a 19-year-old bombardier navigator. I was assigned to the 95th Bomb Squadron, 17th Group. They were stationed on Sardinia. And we had Martin B-26 bombers, a two-engine bomber. We regularly flew over Anzio Beachhead, trying to bomb bridges so the Germans couldn't bring supplies down. And I was on a mission to bomb Monte Cassino, and I remember it very well. I'm sorry I can't give you the date, because it's all marked secret, the targets, but I very well remember the mission.
And Robert, what do you make of the depiction of the war, maybe even that passage in the war, in Ken Burns and Lynn Novick's work?
Well, I think it's very superbly done. We were stationed on Sardinia and Corsica and up in France, and we were living in tents, but we'd fly over Anzio Beachhead regularly and could see what terrible conditions our men were in down there. And occasionally we'd have somebody from the 3rd Division come back to our unit just for a visit, and they'd tell us what it was all like. It was just It was just unbelievably, what the 3rd Division went through down there.
And do you think a documentary can capture that, Robert? Does this one? Does it capture the really hard side of war?
Very much so. Very, very much so. If you look in the Smithsonian Institute, there's a picture of a B-26 with an engine off going down over Toulon, France. And I was not in it, but two of my gunners were. They had eight people, and our two gunners got out, and the other six didn't. So there it is.
Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, he saw it first from the sky, and now he's watching and reliving with your work.
And that's one thing we tried to do, is to show the war from multiple perspectives, not just from the European front and the Pacific and the home front, but also from people who were involved in different aspects of the war. So we do talk to several pilots and to a gunner in an airplane, and also someone who was on a ship, and then people who were in the Marines and in the Army and the infantry. So you really get a variety of perspectives, and you see that they have a different relationship to what the war actually means. If you're a gunner, then your war is in that airplane for those 6 hours that you're over enemy territory. And if you're a grunt, then you're in a foxhole. And if you're on a ship, then the world that you see is just what you can see from the deck of the ship. So we found really interesting to see the different perspectives that people came away from the war with, and how close up they got to seeing some of the carnage.
Well, of course. Let's take a call from South Carolina, Buford. Tim, you're on the air.
Oh, hey, Tom. I just wanted to thank everyone involved in making this film. It's just brilliant. I was born and raised, actually, in Waterbury, Connecticut, and both my parents, who unfortunately passed away last year, my dad was in the Army Air Corps, and, my mom was at home in Waterbury. And it just really, gives me insight not only to what my dad was going through, but really what my mom and the city was going through. And I just wanted to say thank you. My question is, how did you pick the cities or the towns, not just Waterbury, but, Luverne and, Mobile and Sacramento? Was there anything special about those towns, other than their geographic location, that drove you to to pick them?
Ken Burns?
We wanted to pick random towns. We first thought we could tell the story with one town, and we started off with Waterbury. That town was transformed during the war, and they kept their archives so beautifully that it was a delight to start there. But we realized very quickly that the kind of range of combat experience that Lynn just described, we weren't going to get from one town, and that it then seemed incumbent upon us to have it sort of geographically distributed. We'd read a beautiful memoir about World War II by Eugene Sledge, and he was from Mobile, and so that became a town. We knew we wanted to do a West Coast town that would have had a Japanese-American experience and picked not the more familiar ones that would come with lots of baggage and preconceptions, but Sacramento. And then we're thrashing about for a small town in the Middle West and happened to have already met a pilot named Quentin Anenson who'd grown up in Laverne. And almost immediately upon going to Laverne, we also found the newspaper editor, Al McIntosh, who edited and owned the Rock County Star-Herald and sort of reported day-to-day the quotidian details of what it was like for a town that wasn't outwardly transformed the war, but psychologically and spiritually transformed. And most of the folks in the film come from those four towns.
Let's listen to just a little more from the show. Glenn Frazier from Fort Deposit, Alabama, volunteered for the Army July 1941, asked to be posted in the Philippines because he thought the worst fighting would be in Europe, was captured in Bataan on April 9th, 42, at the age of 17, endured the Bataan death march. He was then shipped to a prisoner of war camp near Osaka.
One day I was walking, coming back from a detail that day, on the streets of Osaka, and the weather was cold. And I put my hands in my pocket, and I'm walking along with everybody else. When we got to the camp and they checked us in, this guard pointed me out and called me out and said, "Why did you have your hands in your pocket?" I said, "Because I was cold." So they took me in the commander's office, and the interpreter said, "That's against the military code. Soldiers do not walk with hands in pockets." And I said, "Well, I'm not a soldier. I'm a prisoner of war." So the commander banged his fist on his desk, and he was a major, and got up, and he says, the interpreter said, "He don't like your attitude." So he come up, and he started arguing with me. And I couldn't understand anything he said. So he pulled his saber out, and he said he was going to make an example of you, and so that the other men will understand they have to obey orders. So he puts the sword to my throat here and nicked me a little bit, and I could feel a little bit of blood coming down. So the interpreter said he's going to execute you. So he asked me if I had any last words to say. And I looked him straight in the eye and I said, "He can kill me, but he cannot kill my spirit. And my spirit's going to lodge in his body and haunt him until the day he dies." He had a frown come over his face and took three steps backward and lowered his sword and ordered me to be put in a 5x5x5 cubicle in the ground. I had never seen a Japanese back down in front of any of his subordinates until that particular time. Because once they got to that point, they went through with it, regardless of the results.
And there we are in the thick of it with Glenn Frazier of Fort Deposit, Alabama. Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, co-producers and directors of The War, are with us. Steve's calling right now from Nashville, Tennessee. Steve, what do you think?
Hi, Tom. Hi. Love your show.
Thank you.
Mr. Burns, Mr. Novak, this is Ms. Novak. I'm a little nervous. We love your films in our family. There's endless discussions that come up about, especially the Civil War, since I'm married a Southerner. But I'd like to ask, what are the films that are out, that have come out in recent years, that you think possibly come close to what is really about World War II? One that I've recently seen is Letters from Iwo Jima. That
Clint Eastwood's great film, yeah.
Yeah.
I just can't get out of my mind. Mm-hmm. I just
It's a great question, Steve. Ken, Lynn, what about it? Making this documentary after Saving Private Ryan, after Eastwood's recent work on Iwo Jima, I mean, after everything that's been on film, and quite recently and quite vividly, how did that impact your work?
Well, we began this project, before 9/11. So a lot of those films were not even made, let alone released. But I think what you're doing is you're seeing something that's in the zeitgeist that is curious and will always be curious about the Second World War. And finally, with Saving Private Ryan, with Band of Brothers, and to some extent, Clint Eastwood's letters from Iwo Jima, you're beginning to get a sense in a dramatic, fictionalized way what's going on. These drop you down into specific moments that rarely provide you with a context that I think is also incredibly important to understand. These phenomenal battles don't happen by themselves. And unfortunately, you can stop a screening of Saving Private Ryan after that spectacular opening scene and say, where are we? Why did we land here? What was the consequence of that landing? What's the date? Who was the Axis? What are the Allies? And unfortunately, a majority of people around the country probably won't be able to answer all of those questions correctly. And so what you have are things that remind us, thank God, after so many bloodless, gallant mythologies, that of war, what war is like. And what we're just trying to say is, now can we tell you a little bit about real people who, by the way, when they fall, don't get up again. Everybody in those other films get up at noon and get to go to craft services.
Let me ask you, maybe in the same vein, about all the work that's been done before. Your choice as a documentarian is to go back to first sources here, to soldiers largely who were in the war, but You look back at all the work of Joseph Heller and Norman Mailer and James Jones and James Dickey, I mean, Manchester and Simpson, and not to mention like The Sorrow and the Pity or Showa, Claude Lanzmann. What about all that processing that's gone on in the decades since? Do you miss something of what's been learned when you go back to first sources? Do you know what I mean?
I don't actually think so. I think that this is a seminal event in the history of mankind, and certainly in the 20th century, the most important event. So it's something that we're going to always be revisiting and reanalyzing and reinterpreting and trying to understand its relationship to our lives today and to those who came before. So we'll never be done with it. There will never be the definitive, finished product that will tell us everything about World War II. So we're always influenced by what came before, by where we are today. It's a process. And we know that our film was made in a particular moment in time with access to these veterans. And so they're aware of all those things, too, needless to say. And they live through it. So the thing that really we come down to when we really think about all of this and this anxiety of influence, as you suggest, is that we had an opportunity because these veterans are going to be gone. In 5-10 years, there won't be anybody left who can tell you what they saw, what they did, what happened to them and their friends, all the feelings that they have today. That won't be an opportunity to make that film. Other films can be made with other people talking about all the other issues and thinkers and intellectuals and histories, and there'll be lots more ways to revisit the subject. The film that we made couldn't be made in any other way in the future. So that's why we made this film now, mindful that hopefully other people will do other things in the future because it's going to be an important subject forever.
Mm. Ken Burns, I guess I was thinking in a way less about the anxiety of influence as about the insight of all those earlier thinkers and writers and creators about the war. Does it give you any pause not to include it, or is it just as Lynn says, well, let's capture these vets while they're with us?
Sure, but you're also sort of saying, well, somebody's already painted a bowl of fruit. Why does anyone have to paint another bowl of fruit again?
I guess I mean to say something different than that, which is that there have been some great artists at work here, and when they're not included on this huge recapturing of the war, which will be the war to many young viewers, do we actually lose something? Do we edit out some of the very deep learning that great minds have done in the years since the war?
Well, I'm only speaking for myself, and I suspect I'm also speaking for Ken, that we have read all those great books, and they have informed our understanding of the war as well. So it's not like we're operating in a vacuum, actually. Mm. We're very much aware of and influenced by, in ways that we are aware of, in ways that we perhaps may not be, all the different perspectives that have come to the fore, before now about World War II. So, and as are the veterans who are telling their stories. So that nothing happens kind of in a void, actually. But we really wanted to focus on ordinary people who didn't come with a lot of baggage. So if, for example, we had interviewed Norman Mailer, who I'm sure would have had a great story to tell, he's a celebrity. He's got a presence. You know, he's got a sort of a known story. And that comes with a lot of, not baggage, but just preconceptions. People think they already know because they maybe have already read his wonderful books. We wanted to hear from people that nobody really knew about and let them tell their stories and just find something fresh and new in that. Mm. Of course, it is all a great stream of, you know, understanding of this war that's always flowing. I mean,
and you echo I think a really specious concern that people had at the time of the Civil War, in which they said, "Oh no, this will be the definitive." The Civil War received much more critical press than the war has, and the idea was that this would be the last thing, we would be putting the lid on it, and no one would be able to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And in the 17 years since its broadcast, there have been literally hundreds of more documentaries and hundreds of more books about the Civil War. And as Lynn suggests, mm-hmm. these seminal events, sometimes the small moments as well as these big events like the Second World War, become active topics for each generation. And as we say at the beginning of every episode, the Second World War was fought in thousands of places, too many for anyone accounting. This is the story of four American towns and how their citizens experienced that war. Mm. And what we were trying to do is, in the spirit of William Blake, another great influence, to find the universe in a grain of sand.
No, it's, and we didn't know what we would find when we set out, which is always hard for even me to remember when I see the finished film and it all sort of flows together as if there was some master plan. There wasn't. So we didn't set out with a laundry list of everything we had to include. We just sort of opened our hearts and our minds and our souls to what might be out there. And we were just interested in the human experience of the war and who we might find, who might help us understand it. And that's really how we kind of approach the whole enterprise.
And there it is in 15 hours. Let's take a call from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Britt, you're on the air with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick.
Hi, everyone. Enjoying the discussion very much. I just had a question about the supplemental documentary that's being screened in New York about Latinos. And also was really intrigued by the point I think that Ken made about the war revealing how the best and worst of America was inextricably bound. And I was wondering if the documentary addresses the issue of race, I guess the contradiction that America was fighting a war to eliminate racism in Europe, yet did it under the guidelines of Jim Crow. And I thought of the other person's comment about a variety of perspectives. She mentions, you know, one fighter seeing the war from a deck, but there were people below deck as well, and I'm wondering if they captured that perspective.
Britt, let us go straight to that. I've got a clip here, if I could play, from one of the voices in the film, historian John Hope Franklin, who's been a guest with us on this show. It goes right to your point, Britt. It's about him, a black man, an African-American, being turned away from government service on the basis of race, fitting into a larger theme of racial discord that does get notice in this documentary.
I went down to the recruiting office, the Navy, and volunteered. I volunteered in response to the call that they made specifically for men to man the offices. The recruiter for the Navy said, "What can you do?" I said, "Well, I can run an office. I can type. I can take shorthand if that's needed." I said, "Oh, yes, I have a PhD in history from Harvard." I wondered what he was going to say. He said, "You have everything but color." And I said, "Well, I thought that was an emergency, but obviously it's not, so I bid you a good day." And I vowed that day that they would not get me because they did not deserve me. If I was able, physically, mentally, every other kind of way, able and willing to serve my country, and my country turned me down on the basis of color, then my country did not deserve me. And I vowed then that they would not get me.
Though many minorities did serve, Ken Burns, Britt in Albuquerque, asked about the controversy over the inclusion or otherwise of Latinos. That must have been tough for that to break over your head late in the game. You brought them in. What did you make of that and the responsibility that's suggested by the complaint?
Well, you know, we never started out to be definitive, and as the disclaimer that I said appears in every episode proves, we were going into these towns sort of open to whoever came forward to us. We weren't seeking, with the exception of Japanese Americans and to a lesser extent African Americans, a theme I've pursued in nearly every film that I've worked on, any particular ethnic identity. In fact, there are many groups not included in the film. We were not seeking a definitive portrait. So it was disheartening to learn that people were criticizing the films without seeing a frame of it, not understanding the idea that you can't tell every story and that everyone in our film has to stand in for everyone else. And in fact, we weren't looking for that which made people distinct as much as what made them universal. In Arthur Schlesinger's great dictum, there's too much pluribus and not enough unum. But, you know, I've been telling stories in American history for more than 30 years about stories that haven't been told and, in fact, included Hispanic narratives in many, many films and currently ones I'm working on. So we just listened and decided, as is the obligation of art, to rise above the petty dialectic of not only politics but of intellectual discourse in this country and to honor those Hispanic veterans. We found two extraordinary men who rearranged our molecules with their honesty and prove indeed in the scenes in which they appear in exactly our point. They themselves said, we're not Hispanic, we were American, and that's what they were trying to prove. And
let me ask you, happy about those scenes. Let me ask you finally, our time is short. We hope it's not all petty dialectic. For you personally, how does the story of this war, World War II, inform our understanding of America at war today in Iraq?
I think that's an excellent question. We did not make a film with any political aspirations. We made a film, as Lynn suggested, that was looking at the experience of combat and what it was like for a handful of people to do it, and therefore extrapolating a larger sense of what happened in the Second World War. But history is the set of questions we in the present ask of the past. It cannot help but be informed and reverberate and echo with all that's going on now. In the Second World War, the war touched every family on every street in every town in America. Today, we have a separate military class that suffers its losses apart and alone from the rest of us. In shared sacrifice, Franklin Roosevelt knew, we would become richer, not just spiritually and communally, but financially and materially richer. And we did in the efforts that people made at home, from kids collecting scrap up to someone at the front lines. Today, we don't give up anything. We are all independent free agents. We were asked after 9/11, for example, to go shopping. And so we have a profoundly different thing. And yet, uniting all the wars are the same experiences. I saw bad things. I did bad things. I lost good friends. And that's at the heart of what's going on in Iraq today, and what went on in the Second World War.
Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, co-producers and directors of The War, the great big epic documentary, goes on this weekend. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.